what's your memory of the school? You know, it's not meetings with the ABA, it's not committee meetings, and it's not faculty meetings. It's seeing those students genuinely excited and moved, and to look at them and know that it's that pebble in the pond. What we have put in motion, what was put in motion back in 2004 with that first class there, and the lives that they are touching, we will never see the ripples, the impact that they're having. That to me is why the school was founded. What we're doing is going to be important to us, and it's going to be important to people and communities we don't even know at this point.
Welcome to the Charleston School of Law podcast. I'm your host, John Struble. If you enjoy today's episode, we hope you'll subscribe and give us one of those fancy five-star reviews. It helps quite a bit. The show archives are available and streaming online at charlestonlaw.edu/podcast, or subscribe on your favorite player, Spotify, iTunes, and Google Play. Our guest today is Andy Abrams. He is a retired professor of law and dean at the Charleston School of Law. Andy joins us from his summer digs in Canada. Andy, is O Canada your ringtone now?
No, I'm still using the Magnificent Seven ringtone. but I have convinced the people up here that the word y'all is wonderfully efficient words. So you can kind of tell where Karen and I have been and the friends we have, because suddenly the word y'all is being used a lot around Stratford.
Theater community is one of your passions, and you've been doing a lot in the summertime in Canada. That was kind of your draw to that area, wasn't it?
Yes. Stratford is an hour and a half due west of Toronto. Karen and I've always loved the theater, and it was a small town that played very big with wonderful restaurants. They own guns, but they use their guns for hunting animals and not other people. They don't have handguns up here, although one person did admit at dinner the other night that he had a handgun, and all of his buddies who are Canadian turned on him, and he said, hang on, it's because I've got snakes up at our cottage, is what they call it. And they all thought about it for a minute, and they went, well, I guess that's okay.
What's the local fare like up in that area? What are the popular dishes and stuff? Is it very similar to U.S. food, or are there some staples that they eat that we don't traditionally have here in the States?
Every place has their sort of regional. It's like when you go to Wisconsin and everybody wants to talk to you about those damn cheese curds. We're Packers owners. Karen grew up as a Packers fan, okay. So we actually went to Green Bay to watch our son play. And everybody wanted us to eat these cheese curds. And they're going, oh, you can tell they're fresh because they're squeaky. So are mice, but I wouldn't want to eat one.
I was going to say, you don't want your food squeaking.
Hey, oh boy, this food is squeaky. So up here, they've got some dishes that they claim are local, like poutine.
What is that?
It's basically really thick, nasty gravy, and they stick French fries and things in it. Karen's view of the whole thing is, why waste a perfectly good French fry with all that? Right now it's sweet corn season. The corn up here is something they take great pride in, and all you do is you toss it while it's in the husk in the microwave for about 2 minutes. And you don't even need to put butter on it. It's so sweet. So, we're fans of that.
Let me ask you, we are about to celebrate the 20th anniversary at Charleston School of Law. I've got to ask you, are there ever moments where you miss teaching the class, maybe not the prep and the doing the exams and all that? Do you miss the actual interaction with the students at all?
Oh, yeah. No faculty member likes to give tests and give grades. That is clearly the least rewarding part of the job. It's just a necessary evil that comes with it. Yeah, the interaction with the students in the classroom and out of the classroom, that's what drew me to the Charleston School of Law when it was just under discussion. And that was the whole point of it, was if you don't want to teach and you don't enjoy the interaction with students, then we always said, well, this really is not a good fit for you. That daily interaction with students, it was impossible to have a bad day. You wake up in the morning sometimes just not feeling well physically, and you'd think, God, there's just no way in the world that I'm going to make it all the way through this class. But I'll go in, I'll give it my best shot. And next thing you know, you're looking at the clock and you've used up all the time. That adrenaline and that just joy of being in there with students, it, to me, has always defined the school. Hopefully will always define the school.
20 years of law school and what the original vision and mission were, they've stayed pretty much intact. Faculty excellence has been something that has given us local, regional, and national awards for just being so accessible, helpful to students, which they have said themselves, that is the difference between the Charleston School of Law.
When the first conversations began about the law school, it really began with Bob Carr and George Costco sitting down over at the College of Charleston in the faculty lounge. Bob was teaching a class, and Bill Moore, who was the speaker of the faculty at one point and a revered political science professor, two U.S. magistrates thought, well, it might be a cool idea to have a law school. That's where the discussions began. And it really was, they talked to me about it, asked what I thought. I said, well, I think it'd be a great idea. It was crazy to just have one law school in the state, which I had attended. There certainly was a demand for more. And the mission of the University of South Carolina was fine. It was not necessarily as comprehensive as you might want, particularly in terms of they were hiring some incredible faculty, but they were largely, increasingly, the young faculty were focused more on research, which wasn't necessarily going to benefit the students the way that you might hope. And they asked me if I wanted to be involved, and I said, I'm glad to, you know, consult, whatever, but I've got a job. I said, but, you know, you ought to talk to Alex Sanders, because having retired as president, he then ran for the U.S. Senate against Lindsey Graham.
Yep.
And I said, yeah, he's talked about wanting a law school in Charleston. So they talked to Alec, and then they found Ralph McCullough, who was up at USC, and Ed Westbrook, and suddenly you had five guys. Some knew each other better than others, and they're forming the school and kind of figuring out, well, what's the school going to be about? My first year, actually, so I said, you know, there's no way I can come over there and teach. That would be a conflict of interest. And they said, well, would you be the run our foundation for us? I said, yeah, I can do that. After a year of doing that, I got a call and they said, can you come over and meet with us? So I gathered up my foundation information, thought that's what I was going over for. And they said, we've got you over here under false pretenses. We'd like you to consider leaving the College of Charleston and come over and teach and maybe do some administrative work here at the law school. Couple things about that. I'm nearly 20 years in the state system. So, you know, another 5 years and I'll be fully vested. So that wouldn't make a lot of sense. This could be a grand adventure. And I said, yeah, well, the other problem with it is I hated law school. They kind of smiled and I said, no, I'm serious. I hated law school. I hated every minute of law school. When I go into the building, my stomach hurts. I said, I can't work someplace that makes me ill. I said, so why would I go teach in a law school when I hate law school? What did you hate about law school? And I said, I hated the fact that vast majority of faculty I had made it pretty clear that they really didn't want to be in there teaching. They wanted to put in their hour and 10 minutes and get back to their consulting practices, their law practices, that some of them were running out of their offices, their research, anything in the world other than being in there with students. And I said, and the administration was inaccessible. It was like having to go through the inner sanctum to get to see a dean. The one conversation I had with a dean, wouldn't it make sense if, and the dean put his hand up and he said, look, I went to this school. This is how it was done when I was here. It's how it's done now. It's how it'll be done next year. It was basically before the term stay in your own lane was used. You go be a student and leave the running of the school to us. Why would I want to be a part of something like that? And they said, well, think of it this way. We want this to provide the kind of legal education you wished you'd gotten. And I said, so you're telling me that if I come over here and I teach, that that's the highest priority? And they said, yes. And it's the highest priority of the administration? I said, yes. And the highest priority of the board? They said, yes. Our research informs our teaching. And is it okay to spend time outside of class with students, counseling them and mentoring them? Or are we going to get dinged on that? They said, no, that's what we want you to do. And I said, well, if that's the case, then yeah, I'm all in. I went back in, tendered my resignation, and started in October teaching two classes and the classes to catch up because classes had begun, mid-August, I think 3.5 hours. Students were excited and energized. It was their school. They were referred to as the pioneers because it really was an adventure. And you weren't sure what was over the next hill. You know, you really were building it from scratch. And the students were actively involved in it. So they were designing the honor board and the honor code and what kind of curriculum were they going to be interested in. Mm. So there was a huge amount of interaction. And that initial faculty, some of whom are still at the school, he had this faculty that were just pumped up. Class would end and the students would be flocking to the front of the classroom to talk to the faculty. And then they would leave and go out into the hall and it looked like the Pied Pipers. And it was just an energy and an excitement that existed. It really was all hands on deck. Students, faculty, staff, such as it was. And so you really had everybody pitching in to do whatever it takes. Yeah. And the students had such a sense of that as well.
You said the students were fired up and they were pioneers, knew they were creating something brand new. The school wasn't accredited at the time, so I really admire their willingness to trust and to invest in the school and put their fingerprints on some of the original formations of some of the organizations. What do you think was the draw to them?
One, of course, Charleston itself was really exploding as a place that people wanted to be. That was part of it. There was a pent-up demand. You had people who were in Charleston for a variety of reasons, who couldn't go up to Columbia, so they were working here. There was also a pent-up demand for another law school. You had a number of people who had lots of options. I mean, I taught them. The one thing was, I was teaching all upper-level classes, and the entire time I was at the school, I never taught the 1Ls. And so I was always teaching, you know, sports law and higher ed law and professional liability and professional responsibility. And so I got these students in second year. I mean, we had students who'd been at Ivy League schools who had decided to come down. You had this interesting blend. There was a woman who was had been an Army nurse. She had to have been 70 years old, but she always wanted to go to law school. it was definitely a very heterogeneous group with different motivations. They all felt that what they were doing was going to be important. Why don't go someplace that you know that you can really make an impact? I think that resonated with a lot of the students that we had. They saw that as an opportunity to do something, get a quality legal education, focus on students resonated with them. And I think the idea of being a part of something important made a huge difference.
You said they were called the pioneers, and you don't get to become a pioneer or a trailblazer without taking some chances. And they did that. And I think that's
did they?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes ignorance is bliss.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
Because I think there's some of the students, I think there's some of the faculty and staff who probably looked at it and said, yeah, it's not a given that we will get accreditation. I think that for a large segment of people, students, faculty, staff, community. They looked at it and thought, well, why wouldn't we get accreditation? So it wasn't even, it didn't feel like that big a risk. You knew that it was, the policies weren't quite as refined and you didn't have as large a staff or as large a faculty, but the accreditation issue didn't seem like that big a deal at the moment because you knew you had quality faculty, you had a board that was going to, you know, do what was necessary in terms of facility and staff and meeting the ABA metrics. And we had a dean who had been founding dean, had gotten accreditation, and Richard Gershon at Texas Wesleyan. He had been at Stetson. Richard knew how to be a dean. He knew how to get accreditation. He knew the ABA system. He'd been on a number of ABA site visit teams. I think we had every confidence that we had the right guy at the helm there, John Benfield. John had been at University of South Carolina. He wouldn't be here if he didn't see this as being something that would happen. And so I think everybody, so was it a risk? Oh, yeah, it's a hell of a risk. Did we all appreciate how risky it was at the time? I'm not sure that we did. You know, you get wrapped up in the excitement of it. And when the students knew that when the site team comes in, and boy, they did. When the site team came in, our students took ownership, you know, accreditation. The site teams are interviewing them in groups, one-on-one, and, you know, what do you think about this? What don't you like? And I mean, our students were, we love this school. We think it's fantastic. It's great.
Did you have a favorite class that you taught, Andy?
Somewhere along the line, I became Mr. Sports Law. It's actually not sports law. It's when they asked me what I wanted to teach, since I had a background in really called sports and the law. Sports law is a misnomer. There's only about a couple percent of the law is really unique to sports. It's antitrust, contracts, torts.
Yep.
We already have a course on the curriculum, you know, in the curriculum, you'd have to go back to the faculty committee to get it changed. And I said, oh, the hell with it. Just call it sports law and I'll do a disclaimer the first day of class. I loved teaching sports law because I had the background in it. But honestly, if you talk to the faculty who were there then, you talk to the faculty now. You ask the original faculty who are still there. I don't think for any of us, I never had a favorite one because getting in the classroom and teaching was what you loved. And the subject matter, we never were asked to teach outside of our wheelhouse, really. Sure. Nobody asked me to go in and suddenly try to teach civil procedure. For all of us, we were always able to teach those things that we loved and felt competent. And that was also different than a lot of schools, because I have interviewed for law school teaching positions on back. You know, maybe we'll find one thing that you like, but you'll need to teach in some other area. And they said, you can be our property professor, go out about property. And I don't even, nothing personal to Dylan and Alitra and our other property professors, but property law when I was in law school was boring as hell. You know, we were always able to teach classes that we knew something about. Yeah, well, the beauty of what we get to do, John, is, and when I was at the College of Charleston, I used to tease friends of mine who were on the faculty, like in the history department. And I said, you know, I would hate your job. They go, why? You're teaching Europe in the 1400s. I said, let me ask you something. When you get up on Tuesday morning, is there anything new that has been happened overnight in Europe in the 1400s? Well, no, not really. I said, and guess what? In our world, it has. Cases are handed down.
Yep.
Every day there are disputes. Every day laws are passed. Right. I said, it's never the same. And that's the fun of it, is you're continuously having to look at issues and see the law differently. And right. So we go in every class and have aha moments ourselves as faculty. You shoot me now if I had to just go in and talk about what was happening in England in 1420. And it's the same damn thing I talked about last year and last semester and the semester before. Yeah. It always seemed to me that it was one of the great gifts was being able to teach something that was as interesting to me. And the goal that I think all of us as faculty have is we want the students to share our interest understanding and passion for the subject area we're teaching. I always laughed about it. Richard Gershon was a tax professor, and we would sit there and go, you know, sports law is where it's at. I mean, look at this. And he'd go, no, tax law is sexy. No, tax law is a root canal. And he goes, not the way I teach it. So I think if you ask any of the faculty, they think the area they're teaching in is the cool stuff.
Sure.
I mean, they're the cool kids. That's kind of the joy for all of us of teaching, and always has been a defining component of the school. We might not have been the fanciest school. We might not have had all the bells and whistles, but the one thing that nobody could ever say that they did better than we did, and that was have a faculty and a staff that was committed to the students and the students' success. We might not have always gotten it right, but you know, it was also, if we didn't, it was always the joy of teaching. And when I used to recruit faculty as dean, I would tell them, those who were coming out of private practice, I said, you know, the great thing about this compared to doing trial work, in trial work, you don't get a do-over. You give your arguments, you do your examination, cross-examination, and a jury comes back in and they find for you or against you. But what we do, you prepare, you go in, and you give it your best shot. And you know what? If it doesn't quite work, you sit down, you think about it, you talk to colleagues, and you go back in the next class, and you get it right. I think that's what you have at the school, that sense of the classroom is the reason why we're here. Sine qua non, if you like Latin, or raison d'etre, if you like French. Without the students, they don't need the rest of us.
2008, you transitioned from professor to dean.
They called and asked if I would serve as the acting dean. And I said, well, if it has faculty support. Later, they started a search, and I was approached by a couple of faculty asking if I would stay and just serve as the permanent dean. My answer back was, I would, but only if I had unanimous or near unanimous support of the faculty. I'd held deanships and provost jobs, so teaching was pretty sweet gig. The faculty met and passed a resolution asking the board to call off the search and appoint me, and that's how I became dean. It was with unanimous wish of the faculty, and the board then stopped their national search and appointed me as dean.
You know, I always look at, you spent a lot of time in the classroom. When you reflect on the wholeness of your time at Charleston School of Law, what did you learn personally, and how did you grow professionally over that time?
I spent nearly 20 years at the College of Charleston, but no matter what the administrative jobs were, I taught every semester, went through the tenure process, and was a tenured full professor there. Even as dean at the school, I taught every semester. I wouldn't take a job in higher ed. It's why I left private practice, was going to teaching. Administrative was just something that
came with the job.
I guess I was decent at it, or not. They kept giving me different jobs, and maybe they were just moving me around. Wear out my welcome in one area, and they go, here, maybe you can do this instead. But I was always in the classroom, so I don't know. The first week I was at the College of Charleston, I was talking to the president, who is the former dean of the South Carolina Law School, and I said, well, tell me what you think I ought to know. And he kind of laughed, and he said, well, I'll give you a couple of thoughts. The job requires patience. It's contrary to practicing law. Practicing law, if you're patient, you don't make any money. You got to move cases. You got to work on them, because there's another case right behind that one. And if all you're doing is just diddling around with this one file, it's not a very good economic model. And I thought, well, that's sort of interesting. Patience was certainly not a virtue in that firm. I think early on, you realized that this is a different breed of cat. You do need to be patient. That same president told me, you need to be aware of the fact, given the nature of what the complexity of higher ed, legal education, there's no way that you can keep everybody happy, because decisions you're going to make may be the right decision and may make one set of people happy. By its very nature, it may make other people unhappy. And so fairly early on, you wanted to be open. You wanted to be truthful. You wanted to be empathetic not take yourself too seriously, but take what you are doing incredibly seriously and realize that you have 100 problems on your desk. The person who's coming in there, that student with a problem, that faculty member or staff member, this is, if it's not the only problem they have, this is their highest priority. That's why they're in there talking to you. Yogi Berra said, you learn a lot by watching. You kind of watched. And what it always struck me that there was a reason why every religion had a golden rule. That applies personal or professional. You know, how would I want to be treated? How would I want my son or my daughter to be treated in that situation if they were a student? Mm-hmm. How did I want to be treated as a law student? Boy, I remember that. And as a staff member, I never wanted to be screamed at. Keep in mind that golden rule, and it's a roller coaster. Popular saying up in, I grew up in Greenville, South Carolina, which was element of country to it. But the saying up there was, the sun doesn't shine up the same dog's ass all the time. Yeah, it's never as bad as it appears. And it's not going to stay on the good days. It's not going to stay as good. That's the nature of things, personally and professionally. And you just learn over time to just try as best you can to focus on the things that you have control over. We have control over our attitude. We talk to our students about it. It's the same for faculty, same for staff. We can control our attitude and we can control our preparation. I can always make sure that if I look in the mirror, I will know if there's bad outcomes, it won't be because I wasn't prepared. Over time, you just learn to keep your priorities there, stay true to yourself, and that's about the best any of us can do. Talk to students about it. You know, I understand when you sit on the other side, yeah, there are things that I'm telling you that are going to happen. I know you don't like it. I didn't like it. But here is why. As a dean, you try it. Always going to be times where you're delivering news or decisions that you know the faculty will not necessarily agree with. But what they can always know is that above all else, that our commitment is to the institution. Our goal is to do that which is best for the institution, even if it's not necessarily best for us personally. And the school's got to come first. That's how the school has managed to get to 20 years, is basically looking at it and going, okay, I've got to put the institution first. And as long as we've done that, we have thrived. I suspect that when somebody does the 40-year anniversary and they're looking back at the school, those same basic tenets are going to continue to apply.
Mm-hmm. Andy Abrams is our guest. He served as professor of law and dean at Charleston School of Law. And as we near our 20th anniversary, and when I talk to students about you, I talk to faculty about you or leadership about you, they talk about your servant leadership. You would make brownies for students that you would bring into the classroom, but during COVID, you couldn't do that, so you would leave them out on your front porch. How did that come to be? And because I think that's such a great example of servant leadership to your students and appreciation.
That's kind of anybody who would say it. If you're there for the institution, which means you're there for the starting with the students, we are there to be a servant leader to the institution and its constituents. Before COVID, I'd bake brownies and would take them over when the students were studying for exams over in the library. And so it began with that. I just remember how stressful exams were. Mm-hmm. And legal education historically has been a dinosaur on that in terms of one huge exam at the end of a semester, everything riding on that. We're doing a little better with it now, but it's an antiquated system and certainly was always contrary to best information that was out there in terms of student learning, which is frequent feedback and testing that students know how they're doing. Well, that wasn't the case. So you take one mega exam. And so I would bake brownies and walk around the library and ask the students how they were doing and knock on the study rooms. I've got brownies. And they would stop what they were doing. And it gave me a chance, just, how's it going? You know, you're going to be fine. Stick with it. And students would have their favorite seats at tables. And so I'd come by and hand out the brownies. Sometimes it'd be students who were needed gluten-free. So I would make a point to bake a batch of gluten-free brownies and then hunt them up. It was just a way of letting them know that we understood that this was a tough period for them. And exams were a tough period. And I wasn't unique on that. I just happened to bake brownies, but we had so many of our faculty. You know, I think about Bill Jansen, always over at the library, just walking around, giving pep talks to them, answering questions if they had them. Countless faculty doing that. Mine just was, I'll bake brownies and carry them over there. And so then COVID hit, you know, a couple students, I sent a note saying, how you guys doing? And they said, oh, we missed the brownies. And I baked brownies, put them in baskets and put them in bags, put them out on the porch of our house. And then and I put a basket with note cards and a pen and said, just take a brownie and let me know, you know, how you do it. Yep. And so it started with that. And then the students liked it. So I would send an email saying, well, here are the brownies that I've baked for today. And some of them liked particular brownies over others. So I was baking like 3 or 4 dozen a day. I had no committee meetings to go to.
That's right.
You got to use your time somehow. And so I would get up first thing in the morning and start producing. My wife and kids called it Brownie Boy Bakery. And I would be in there baking the brownies. I did little cartoons for each flavor and would have them in the baskets out on the porch. The students would come by and get the brownies. When later in the day, usually in the evening, I'd go out and survey to see which brownies were left. And then I would send a note to the students. And in the morning when I tell them what brownies were there, I would tell them the brownies and then just try to give them some thought. And sometimes the thought was, I feel your pain. We all feel your pain. And sometimes the thought was, look, you still got to pass the bar. You got to represent clients. And no one is going to say, yeah, well, the reason why it's okay that you didn't know the law as well because you were in law school during COVID. You got to stay focused and let's focus on what we can control. And what we can control is sticking with this, learn the material, even under these difficult circumstances. So it was a way of communicating with students. And then in the evening, I'd inventory the brownies and I'd send a note out and I go, okay, night owls, I know you're out there. Anybody needs a study break? I have 4 bourbon caramel brownies, 3 rum raisin, and 2 espresso brownies. First come, first serve. And you know, sometimes 11 o'clock at night, 11:30 at night, I'd hear car pull up, hear people laughing, and they'd come up to the porch and our dog got so used to it. He didn't even bark. His ear, he would just sort of look over at me and I'd go, yeah, it's okay, Bear. Then I started getting emails from some students who said, you know, I missed the brownies, but I had to move home because I couldn't afford a place in Charleston. What's your favorite brownie? And they would tell me, I said, okay, I'll take care of it. I would bake a batch of brownies and put some on the porch and then take some in and drop them off at the school. And Vic Silvis and Diane would load them up, mail them out to the students. God, they probably were so stale. But again, it was just a way of letting students know that we're going to get through this and that we never stop caring. But I wasn't unique. I mean, there was faculty were continuously and staff were always looking for ways to reach out to the students to help them. So, I mean, it's nice of the students to say it's like anything else. When you give, when you share, I got as much out of it as they got out of
sure.
it. And I use Ghirardelli chocolate. It was only the best ingredients because I'm going to serve them what I would want. We thought about buying stock in Ghirardelli. It turns out it was privately held, so I never even got that benefit. Sort of the last piece of all of it was the greatest joy was commencement. And you commented on it once and people would go, they go, you look like you're having so much fun up there. And I said,
I am.
I admit it, I am. This is the most joyous thing in the world. To me, commencement was a joyous celebration and to be able to see those students and look out and see their families and friends out in the audience, but see those students come across the stage and be able to give them a handshake and for a lot of them a hug. God, it doesn't get any better than this. This is why we're all here. And then you would watch and they would leave the stage and they're walking down that stage and they're walking past the faculty sitting on the front row and the faculty are standing up and hugging their students. What's your memory of the school? You know, it's not meetings with the ABA, it's not committee meetings, and it's not faculty meetings. It's seeing those students genuinely excited and moved and being able to share that moment with them and to look at them and know that it's that pebble in the pond. What we have put in motion, what was put in motion back in 2004 with that first class, what is in motion today is we are contributing and putting these students out there and the lives that they are touching. We will never see the ripples, the impact that they're having on the lives of these clients of theirs, the lives of the community that they're having. That to me is why the school was founded throughout those years, whether it was Richard Gershon in 2004 taking that risk, whether it was that initial faculty and Nancy Zisk and Allison Haynes Stewart, who are still there, who sure had better things to do and safer things to do with that same sense of purpose, whether it's the faculty who have come after them, whether it's that first class, whether it's that class that just arrived, it is really that sense of what we're doing is going to be important to us, and it's going to be important to people and communities we don't even know at this point.
Yeah. Final question brings us back to commencement. One of your signatures was your baseball cap. You even wore it when you delivered commencement. You pulled it out and put it on. When did you begin wearing the baseball cap?
I lost all my hair. There's a functional purpose to it. There's sort of an aesthetic purpose. One was I lost all my hair and I have had, probably will have, skin cancer. So it was sort of, I needed to cover my head anyway, now inside. And I love sports. I don't know, John. Like I said, you take what you're doing seriously, but try not to take yourself too seriously. And it always seemed to me that I'm a pretty upbeat person. If somebody came into my office and you saw my office had no diplomas. And I promise I did graduate from a few places, but no pictures in my office of me shaking hands with famous people or autographs from Senator this or anything. My office was sports photos and largely baseball photos and paintings, with Jackie Robinson being a lot of them because he was and still is a hero of mine. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, when people see me, maybe they understand you're Dean, but you're just another regular person who happens to have this job. That to me, it made it easy. And then I like ensembles. So when I wore a suit, I make sure the hat went with the tie and the suit.
That's right.
And then when I stepped down as Dean, I gave away 3/4 of my suits and a bunch of the ties, because the tie is nothing but a silk noose as far as I can tell. I mean, yeah, I'd like to choke the son of a bitch who thought that was the height of fashion. Shirts that went with the hats. When we came back and we had the mask, I found that you could get masks that went with the teams that you were wearing. And so I would have a hat and a shirt mask that matched. And I guess one of the last classes I taught before we started class, one of the students said, "Before you begin, I've got a bet," and pointed to the person beside him and I said, "What's the bet?" And they said, "The bet is that you will have different matching outfit for every class that we take this semester." I said, "Who'd you bet with?" And the young woman said, "Steve." And I said, "Well, which way, how much is the bet?" And she said, $20. I said, "Which way did you bet?" And she said, "Oh, I bet that you would." I said, "Steve, you might as well give her the money now." That's the story behind the hat, story behind the brownies, story behind why I came to the school, and the story behind why I think that the law school is one of the great stories. You look at all of those schools that popped up, those for-profits. Talk about last man, last one standing. We're now converting over to not-for-profit. What an incredible story.
Yeah, it really is.
That we're here and thriving and have been fortunate to have terrific leadership with Richard Gershon, who was such a steady hand and knew his stuff, take us through that. They let me play around for 12 years at the helm, and Larry Cunningham has come in and brought his energy and his skills and insight. The school is organic and will never be. Today in 2024, it's not going to be the school that it was in 2004, and in 2044, it won't be the school it was to date. Those core elements of the school served it well then, it serves it well now, and God willing, that will remain the heart of the school. When someone does interviews like this in 2044 and says, well, what is the Charleston School of Law about? Hmm. And the answer still comes back and says, at the end of the day, it's about touching the lives of students, will impact their lives while they're here so they can go out and impact the lives of the people they serve and the communities they serve.
And on that note, what a great interview, Andy. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to share some of your memories and stories about the first 20 years. And I'm so grateful for all you've done and the encouragement you've been to me and to the school and to all the lives you've impacted here at Charleston School of Law, to the students and faculty and leadership. So thank you very much. And thanks for joining the Charleston School of Law podcast.
Hey, man, the thanks are all mine, John.